So, well, good morning, everybody. We are engaging this book of Ezekiel again. We're very near the end. We possibly will finish up in a week. This and it's a long book. It'll be good to be through it. But these last chapters are the most debated in the book, if not in the whole Bible. Chapters 40 through 48 bring the book to an end. They are part of the focus on the restoration of Israel. And what is so debated is that it will give a lot of discussion of a temple that at least those from a dispensational perspective take to be a temple in the millennium. And it not only gives the specifications, I mean, it goes into fairly great detail about which priest will serve there, the new role for Levites. Animal sacrifices, which is the biggest problem passages, I guess, if you want to say it that way, that get debated, animal sacrifices. So there's a lot here that gets talked about. And the ultimate question, of course, is whether this stuff is literal or figurative and that kind of thing. I want to look at a little bit of chapter 40 to get a flavor for this. Don't get hung up on all the dimensions. But just observe the fact that it gives the dimensions in exacting detail that seems to belie a purpose of being symbolic. And this is one of the biggest challenges for those who take it in a non-literal way, which is virtually everybody, because they have to deal with why he wastes so much paper, so much ink on very exact measurements, dimensions. And the best that usually can be said is that there's some things he doesn't give dimensions for, so it must not be literal. So I want to look at a little of this, and then I'm gonna show you a paper I did a while back. I just want to pull some quotes from it. It's so I can let you see that different views on this matter of the temple. And the sacrifices up here in the chat. I'm going to try to put if it'll copy in there. Yeah. I put a link there in the chat to the paper. If it's something you want to download, I actually have a website. It's not a great one, and I don't update it often, but it does have a few articles there. And I wrote this one a long, long time ago. I might would write it a little different today, but I did spend a lot of time in it and quote sources that are taking a non-literal view and sources that take a literal view. And we'll look at a few of those quotes to understand the argument for and against a literal temple, and in particular for and against literal implementation of sacrifices. Again, that's the piece that really causes the issue. And the primary passage, there's a couple of Old Testament references about the sacrifices coming back. But the primary passage is here in Ezekiel. So this is the place to talk about it. So Ezekiel 40 begins talking about a new temple. It has a date marker for us that's helpful. It's the 25th year of our exile at the beginning of the year. So that tells us it would apparently either New Year's Day or at least close to that. But then it says on the 10th day of the month. Now, he doesn't tell us which month, and that makes it difficult, but he tells us it's the beginning of the year. And the difficulty there, if you've not heard this before, is that you have a Jewish religious calendar, and the first month is Nisan, how it's spelled, like Nisan. I may be saying it wrong, but it's how it's spelled, Nisan. And that's in kind of April, May time period on our calendar. But they would later have a more of a civil calendar, a governmental type calendar. And the first month is Tishri, Tishri, which occurs in October, November. So the question when it says it's the first month of the year is, do you mean Nisan or Tishri? That's, and people debate it. I will tell you, if it is under the religious calendar, so that it's the new year under the religious calendar, and they would celebrate New Year with, usually Feast of Trumpets back when it was still done. Well, then that would make it April 28th, we think, of 573 BC, April 28th. But if it's the civil calendar that came into place later, it would make it October 22nd. And because it says here, you notice it says the 10th day of the month. The 10th day of the month is Yom Kippur. And that certainly leads me to think that maybe that's what's intended, that there would be some significance there, because Yom Kippur is gonna change. This stuff's all looking forward to Christ coming and things like that. So maybe, but in either event, it's 573 BC. It gives us a time marker. The city fell 586, 587, 586 BC. And he says that it's 14 years after Jerusalem had been captured. So it gives us that time marker from 586, 587. It's a vision of God, and he takes the prophet, and according to verse 2, to the land of Israel. This happened earlier in the book where he was somehow taken. We don't know if he was physically there, as he's just seeing it in a vision, but he was taken on a tour of the temple. It was early in the book, and we saw that around chapter 9, 10, 11, taken on a tour of the temple as it then existed before it was destroyed. Now it's as if he's taken on a tour of a temple that has not been built yet, a future temple. And now, having said that, not everybody agrees that's what it is, but we'll come back to the different views on it. But it seems to be a future temple, and he's being given the guided tour. And it was, you know, if you think back on those early chapters, when he went to the temple and he saw the idolatry there, it was highly detailed. And it is highly detailed here. So he goes and he sat down on a very high mountain. A very high mountain. Now you notice he doesn't tell us which mountain. And you know, when I show you some of the objections to this being literal, one of the big arguments is this isn't a real mountain, and so nothing else in the vision is real. Just think about that. Does that really hold weight? Well, we'll come back to it. On its southern slope was a structure resembling a city. He brought me there, and I saw a man whose appearance was like bronze. It's hard for us to maybe imagine this, but this idea of somebody, maybe an angelic being or something, having a measuring rod. You see, it goes on. He says he has a linen cord and a measuring rod. This is not unique here. If you read the third night vision of Zechariah, Zechariah had eight visions on one night, and they're covered in chapters 1 through 6. And in chapter 2, it's the third vision, and it opens up with a man carrying a measuring rod to measure the boundaries of Jerusalem. So kind of that thing in the prophetic literature occurs, and I think there's something similar as well in Revelation. So, you know, it's kind of it seems to be a recurring imagery. He was standing by the city gate. That has to be in verse 3. That's Jerusalem. But I don't think it's the Jerusalem of their day, right? Because that Jerusalem had been destroyed. The very fact that he's standing by the city gate is telling these people there's a future for Jerusalem at a time when the city is demolished. It's more or less empty. There's very few people left there. So this is future. He spoke to me, "Son of man, look with your eyes, listen with your ears, and pay attention to everything I'm going to show you." If he needs to look, listen, and pay attention, I think it's he says that because of the exacting nature of the description he's going to give. That does not suggest just a big picture sort of symbolism, but we'll continue. "You've been brought here so that I might show it to you. Report everything you see to the house of Israel." So he's going to go and see all this stuff, not only about a new temple, but I mean later in the book, toward the end, it's going to talk about the priesthood. It's going to talk about what land the tribes get, all kinds of stuff. He says, "Take it all back and tell the people." If this is future stuff, it is fascinating how often we'll hear people say that prophecy doesn't matter. If prophecy is unimportant or impractical, why does God give what we're going to see to follow here, 8 chapters, 9 chapters actually, of prophecy from 40 to 48? And he says, this is critical. Pay attention, look carefully at it, think about it, tell these people everything you see, right? It's one of those things that's around backwards, and it's been a frankly a big problem for the New Testament church, and I've been in places that have downplayed the importance of the Book of Revelation and anything that may look to the future, because it's difficult to interpret, and at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. What if God thinks it does matter? And maybe it matters a whole lot, like it's really important. I think he thought it was important for Ezekiel's audience. So just something to think about. There was a wall in verse 5 surrounding the outside of the temple, and I'm going to share a screen here if I can as I read through a little bit of this. Let me go find share screen. Are you able to see the shared screen? Hopefully.
Yes.
Now this is out of the Bible Knowledge Commentary. I'm citing the source. I'm not trying to, pass this off as mine. I don't know how exactly it'll look, what's going to be described. This is a very simple kind of a drawing, but I would suggest to you, go online and you may find some stuff like this. Of course, it's not all consistent, but it's just helpful to. As you're going through all these dimensions, you can't keep them in your head, but people that are architecturally minded can have made drawings like this one and written down the dimensions. The Hebrews measuring it in cubits, and we get told early on they're what we call long cubits, verse 5. It wasn't the normal cubit that the older temple, the Temple of Solomon, was done in. It's a little longer. It's a cubit plus. A little bit more, so it's 21 inches, and that's basically verse 5. So everything's measured in these cubits, but a bit bigger, which is not a surprise. This thing's huge. But I will say, I've heard read in a number of places this idea that, well, this thing's way too big. It's just not realistic. The first time I went to China, I went to Beijing first. We flew in there. We were there to do our first adoption. It was in China. And so we got to do all the touristy things, which includes going to the Forbidden City. I don't know if anyone's ever been there, but the Forbidden City gives you perspective when people start saying, oh, this is too big, it can't be real. That Forbidden City's huge. It was basically across the street from Tiananmen Square, which I kind of walked around there. That's where a lot of people in our country are trying to take us. And you go to the Forbidden City, and it has these huge courtyards that you walk through a gate and in a wall. There's a big wall around a huge courtyard, and you tend to walk up or down some steps through a gate into a big courtyard, and I mean big. There might be a temple in there, some building you can see, huge, bigger than a football field, white, huge. And then you walk through the whole thing across the courtyard. There's another wall and another gate. And you probably can go look at this online. I'm sure someone has a tour. It's really kind of neat to do. And you do this, and I'm out there for hours, right? And I'm walking through these big courtyards. There's tons of stuff to see. This thing is centuries old. And every time I seem to walk through another courtyard, there's another one, another gate, another set of steps. And these gates are in walls that are thick. I mean, it's just this tremendous thing until you finally get to the place that has the palace where the king used to live and all that kind of stuff. And I'm just saying, the whole idea that it's too big is just absurd. I mean, people built big things before, and you can go look at them. So don't listen to that stuff. Well, it's too big. How big is too big if God's the architect, right? And when you read Zechariah, though, in those 8 night visions, he will tell Joshua the high priest and Zerubbabel the governor that they are going to be instrumental in rebuilding the temple in their day, which will be the temple that's standing when Jesus is born, although Herod will remodel it and make it bigger. But at the same time, Zechariah tells the people there's another temple that's going to be built by the Messiah. And that's important because it will have the cooperation of people from the nations who will bring gold and silver to it and all that kind of stuff. But this is Jesus's building project, and to say, well, it's too big for Jesus, really? Just, start putting the pieces together, and there's really no surprise that it could be this big. Well, let's get a little idea of this. But I thought showing you the picture, you can kind of just, when you read some of this, you can kind of relate it to the picture. It says that the measuring rod in the man's hand was basically 10.5 feet long. Verse 5 still, he measured the thickness of the wall and it was 10.5 feet. He has a measuring rod in his hand, and we're told it was 6 units of 21 inches. In other words, about 10.5 feet. So basically that rod that he's carrying, which was how people would measure, they would put the rod end to end and measure. That's how thick the wall is on the outside. And so you go through. Now, in the bottom of this picture is the gate that our hero walks through, and this gate is east. This is the east gate at the bottom. Okay. Now this matters, and he's going to walk through the east gate in a minute, but you're going to have, and I'll move this up a little, we can see the directions here. So you've got the north gate on the right, the south gate on the left, and there's not a west gate that he'll describe. If you recall the earlier chapters, when he got the guided tour of the temple, he visibly saw God leave the temple. His presence in a physical sense left the temple, and it left out the east gate. What he's going to say in a bit, then we may not get to read it today, but is that God in this future temple will enter the east gate, and the east gate will be closed. It will not remain open. And I think it's symbolic of the fact that God will never again exit the temple. Okay. That his presence, as long as this temple is standing, that is, he will not exit it. So he says that the thickness of the wall was 10.5 feet and its height was the same. Okay. We can understand that. 10.5 feet tall. Then he came to the gate that faced the east, and he climbed its steps. So he's climbing up the east gate. He measured the threshold of the gate, 10.5 feet deep. One threshold was 10.5 feet deep. Each recess was 10.5 feet long. It's got some little recesses in here and details. And, we can't say exactly where they're positioned, but gives you an idea of what it might look like. The inner threshold of the gate on the temple side next to the gate's portico was 10.5 feet. Next, he measured the gate's portico. That's an area kind of like a porch where you could stand in it. It was 14 feet. The jambs were 3.5 feet, and the gate's portico was on the temple side. So the portico's out here, like you would out, the porch kind of looking toward the temple, I think. And he goes into a lot of the detail. He says in verse 15, the distance from the front of the gate at the entrance to the front of the gate's portico on the inside is 87.5 feet. I mean, look how exact these things are. The recesses and their jambs have beveled windows all around. The porticos also had windows all around. Each jamb was decorated with, you see that? Palm trees. Palm trees. Now, I want to make a thing about these palm trees, and then let's talk a little about some big features here. If I continue reading and I get up to, because I'm not going to belabor all these measurements, other than, and I'm also not going to tell you they all stand for something. That's, we don't know that. I think they're measurements architecturally, like these are the measurements. But when you keep reading, you'll find in verse 21. That it talks, 22 rather, it's talking about other parts of it. Verse 20 says he measured the gate of the outer court. That's here. So you're gonna, you go to a gate, you get into the outer court, and then there's another gate to get into the inner court, okay? And so he's gonna measure these things. And in verse 20, he's measuring the gate of the outer court facing north. That would be this guy over here. on the right-hand side, the outer court gate facing north, and basically the dimensions turn out to be the same whether you're at the east, north, or south gate. But I wanted you to catch this. Its windows, portico, and palm trees, there it is again, had the same measurements as those of the gate that faced east. Then if you go down to the description of the inner gates, and you see three of them here in the diagram, description of the inner gates, which that description begins in verse 28 and goes through verse 37. But when you catch this one idea, verse 34, describing how these inner gates look inside them, its portico face the outer court. Right here, as you go in, is a little area where you can stand, a kind of a porch, if you will, and it looks out. This one at the bottom, the east gate, that portico looks in. And within the portico, it's decorated with palm trees on each side. Hear that? Palm trees on each side. And then as we go to verse 38, he starts talking about some rooms that are in here for preparing sacrifices. And so, like in verse 42, there were tables of cut stone for the burnt offering. And the utensils, again in that same verse, were used to slaughter the burnt offerings, and the other sacrifices were placed on them. We're going to come back to this, but this is why there's so much of it's not just it's a temple. Apparently, there's still sacrifices, and you'll see this little A right here in the middle of the inner courtyard. So just dead center in the diagram, that's the altar, and he's going to describe those dimensions in a while. Altars. It's kind of funny in church. Sometimes in church, they'll say, you know, if you know, in a church that does like invitations, I've been in, they'll say, come up to the front to the altar for prayer or something. And I get what they're saying, but the altar there is some steps with carpet on it. An altar is where you put dead animals on top and burn them up. I mean, that's what it means. It's kind of a weird thing, but there's an altar there. And people would say, why is there an altar there? Jesus died once for all, according to Hebrews. And according to Hebrews, the blood of bulls and goats won't take away sin, something Paul would also say elsewhere. And so why on earth is there an altar there? When you get to chapter 44, it says in chapter 44 in the opening verses that he's brought back to the east gate and it was closed. They closed the east gate. The Lord said to me, this gate will remain closed. It will not be opened and no one will enter through it because the Lord, the God of Israel, has entered through it. Therefore, it will remain closed. He's hallowed it with his presence. But the real emphasis is that unlike the temple Zerubbabel would build, God's presence will be in this temple manifested. And so I want you to see that. There's one other piece, and I want to go show you the paper. Yeah. No. Hold on a second. Let's see here. Yeah. So chapter 46 talks about sacrifices at appointed times. So I'm looking ahead because I want just to kind of put together some of these difficulties and we'll think through them. This is what the Lord God says in chapter 46, verse 1. The gate of the inner court that faces the east is to be closed during the 6 days of work, but opened on the Sabbath. So you see these references and opened on the day of the new moon. The prince should enter from the outside by way of the gate's portico and stand at the gate's doorpost while the priest sacrifices burnt offerings. You know, again, burnt offerings are there. And it goes on in great detail about it. So let's back off of this thing. And what I want to focus on for a moment is this matter of sacrifices. And then, you know, if there's questions or thoughts about that, we can talk about it. But I'm going to share my screen again, but with this paper that I had, like I said, I put it in the chat if you're interested in downloading this thing. And I'm not saying it's great, but it is pretty succinct in dealing with this stuff. the real challenge is the temple literal? And then you get the sacrifices, which many have said is the best argument against dispensationalism, is these sacrifices. And what I would say is you have to take them together. It's kind of, it seems, after describing the temple, he describes what the priests do there, including the sacrifices and keeping some feast. It's either literal sacrifices in a literal temple or not literal sacrifices and not a literal temple. It would make no sense at all if it's a real temple, but then the sacrifices are not. Does that make sense? Any just kind of at the gate, kind of starting out, is there kind of a question or thoughts, so far, and then we'll jump into what the experts say? Okay. Well, here is I'm really just going to highlight some things from this article, but I had good quotes from smart people. And kind of what I said in the first of this, there are several references in the Old Testament to reinstituting animal sacrifices, and I put some of those down in chapter one. I mean, footnote one. Isaiah 56, Isaiah 66. It's not just here in Ezekiel, but the Ezekiel passage is the main one. Judd?
I have a
Okay.
question. I
Yeah.
don't understand why, to me, just the opposite of what you just said. Why is the sacrifices against dispensations? I always thought like the sacrifices proved that you have to have dispensations.
Yeah, it's the idea that because Christ has died now, and we don't need animal sacrifices like we did, I say we, right? Israel did under the law of Moses. Dispensationalists have to be consistent in their hermeneutic, and so they take a literal view of these sacrifices in the future, in the millennium, and it's like, well, wait a second, we're done with sacrifices. That all got replaced. Christ died for our sins. You don't need animal sacrifices anymore. So that's the reason. It's not that there were sacrifices back in the day. It's that there's going to be sacrifices in the future, according to dispensationalists, and that they say just doesn't make theological sense.
Okay, thank you. I get it now. I
Yeah.
didn't get it at all. Thank you.
So the most extensive passage is this Ezekiel 43:18 through 46:24, and so we haven't read all that, but I just want to tee it up now because they go together. Temple and sacrifices and the priesthood, they kind of all go together. This is either literal stuff or it's not. You may not have heard of some of these names, but I'll just give you an idea who they are. I'm quoting on this on the screen, Dwight Pentecost. He was a traditional, I'll call it a classical dispensationalist, at Dallas Seminary. He taught there forever. He was a student of Lewis Berry Schaeffer. And maybe even Harry Ironside. Ironside. Pentecost lived to be 100. He ended up living on campus until he died, and he taught till he was 100. A very remarkable man. He has a good dispensational book that was really his dissertation in the 1950s called what is it? Oh, now I'm losing it. It may even be here in the footnote. Yeah, Things to Come. It's what I footnoted in number two. So J. Dwight Pentecost, Things to Come. And he's got a lot of good books. I mean, I'm not on the same page with him and everything, but just understand this guy was super influential. He was a favorite professor of more than one generation of classical dispensationalists coming out of Dallas Seminary. That's gone for the most part now. The school's changed. But he said in his sort of classic book, that's a good overview of prophecy and dispensationalism, an alleged inconsistency between this literal interpretation and the teaching in the New Testament concerning the finished work of Christ, which brought about the abolition of the Old Testament sacrificial system, has been used by the millennialist to reduce the premillennial system to an absurdity and to affirm the fallacy of the literal method of interpretation. And that's what I'm saying earlier, right? This is a battleground right here in Ezekiel that those who are pretty studied on the subject, who would not accept a dispensational position, this is where they go, because they say this is where your dispensational hermeneutic gets you tied in a knot, and there's no way out. And so the premillennialists, the dispensationalists are all wrong. So I just want, had that framed there. Now, at the outset, I point out that the interpretation of Ezekiel 40 to 48, dealing with the temple, cannot be divorced from the verses dealing with the animal sacrifices. And that's what I was saying earlier. They're going to live together or fall together in terms of a literal hermeneutic. It's just not congruous to take a literal approach to, most of the passage and then cut out part of the passage and say, I don't take that literally. Although that's what so many Bible readers do today. They take the parts they don't like and we could call it spiritualize them or simply remove the pages. So here are the primary, I'm not saying this is every view in the world, but these are the primary views of Ezekiel 40 to 48 that I've highlighted. You'll see that I'm taking this from Walvoord. Do y'all know who Walvoord was? That you've heard that, John Walvoord?
Yes.
Good. He had a he was most known for his prophecy books and teachings. Again, classical dispensationalist. He was the president of Dallas Seminary at some point. He overlapped with Dwight Pentecost, although I think he passed away first. But he does have a lot of really fine books. He's got a small commentary, I think, on Thessalonians that I really enjoyed. And he's got a great book on the rapture, and it's just full of reasons why the rapture will be before the tribulation. And so anyway, just lots of good books. But here's what he says, outlining the five major views. Ezekiel's description about the temple is really about Solomon's temple. He's looking back to the temple that was destroyed 14 years earlier. Number two, the description provides specifications for Zerubbabel's temple. When you read the book of Haggai and Zechariah, they're prophesying at the same time around 520 BC. And their primary focus is that the temple that had been destroyed would be rebuilt, although understand it's not rebuilt to the same specifications. And in fact, that's something that some of the folks who had been alive at the time of the old temple that remembered it were complaining about. It's not as big and fancy as Solomon's temple. But so they say, this is really just specifications for Zerubbabel's temple. Number three, the description is an ideal, which the returning pilgrim should have observed but did not. It's some kind of, ideal, but they just didn't do it. I guess in terms of constructing a temple. Number four, the description was intended to be a typical presentation, in other words, a type or a picture, only to be fulfilled by the church in the present age. This is the common view today. This is about the church. We just take things that Ezekiel's told to go back and tell the people in exile, all of whom without exception are Jewish, right? It tell them about this temple, but it's really not for them, right? It's for the church. And number five, Ezekiel's temple is literal and will be constructed during the millennial period. And if I were writing this today, I would add by Jesus Christ that he would be be in charge of it, and that's confirmed in Zechariah. So, what's wrong with number one? What do you think? I mean, I know I haven't read all of it, but you get the idea. And I showed you the diagram. It's architectural dimensions for something that could be constructed. What is wrong with number one? The view that the description just provides specifications looking back to Solomon's temple that already been destroyed.
I looked ahead to to your next sentence, but yeah, I mean it's the dimensions are much different and much bigger, so it can't be.
They just don't work because it's just not the same dimensions. And that's really the problem with number two, because this temple is going to be bigger than Solomon's, and Solomon's was much bigger than Zerubbabel's. Zerubbabel's temple We know that because the witnesses complained about it, and both Haggai and Zechariah make note of that they view it, in Zechariah as a day of small things, because the temple's smaller, which God rebukes them for, because the real issue is whether or not God's blessing it. Number three, it just doesn't have any support in the sense that when you read the later writings, no one ever refers back to this. And says, and makes any application of it in some way like this. Like they're not even thinking about this. You really get to number four. Four is the main one, and so it's really to be spiritualized is something fulfilled by the church. And I have a personal problem with that because I'm committed to a literal hermeneutic, but understand that most people don't have that problem. They have a problem believing this thing could be real. And so we're gonna look at that. So we're gonna address that. Here is Daniel Block. Now he's a Dallas Seminary professor, also not classical dispensationalist, which is where I stand. And if you say, well, what do you mean by that? Charles Ryrie has a good book called Dispensationalism. It's not very long. That's where I'm at, pretty much. I mean, I don't get into, this is just me. I'm not being critical of it. Early on, like with Clarence Larkin, you start getting these big diagrams and stuff, and some people like that. Like I don't, get so much into that. I'm not saying he's wrong. But more in that general sense in which Ryrie describes it, that God deals with his people and humanity at large in different ways at different times. The basis for salvation never changes. It's by grace through faith. The content of what they might have known changes because people in the days of Moses, would not have had a way really to know per se that a man named Jesus, the God man, would come at a certain point and die on a Roman cross and raise again, but they could have faith, and so I'm kind of that classical. And what's happened in more recent times is at the seminary, and I'm not saying everybody because I know people there that have not abandoned a more classical view of dispensationalism, but a lot of the leading faculty have, and it's actually been somewhat a, as I understand it, kind of a point of controversy. And Dan Block's one of them. You'll get the sense from this quote talking about this. He says, oh, by the way, so he promotes something called progressive dispensationalism. You can look that up. I think it's a poor use of a term. He says Ezekiel's account should not be interpreted as a blueprint to follow in an actual construction project. Okay. So I say the opposite. It's a blueprint that Jesus will follow and others will build in an actual construction project. So there's no middle ground for us, right? It's real or it's not. He goes on, he says, although the analytic tone has a ring of realism, what does he mean, the analytic tone? It's the numbers. They're exact. And it's not just a couple of numbers. They go on and on and on. So that's what he's talking about, this analytic tone. With numerous reminiscences of earlier plans, what he means is what in the modern day we call it Easter eggs that kind of look back to the earlier temples. And one of those is the palm trees I mentioned earlier. And I'd mentioned that a few times. I pointed out and didn't tell you why. Any idea what the significance is of the palm trees? I don't know if you've thought about that. When you go read about the tabernacle, right? Not the first temple that Solomon built, but the tabernacle. It was a tent that could be moved around. It had the Ark of the Covenant in it. The curtains surrounding the Holy of Holies that had the Ark of the Covenant were covered with cherubim, okay? Right? What are cherubim? Well, they're like the angels we met in Ezekiel 1 that surround the very presence of God on his chariot. So when you go into the presence of God, there's cherubim embroidered on the curtains, so you can go in. Do you remember an earlier time in history where you would have to go past the cherubim to get to the presence of God before the tabernacle? Where do we first see cherubim in the
The
scripture?
they're guarding the entrance to the Garden of Eden so that Adam and Eve can't get back in.
Exactly. They're guarding the entrance to the Garden of Eden so that Adam and Eve, after the fall, can't get back in. But after the fall, cherubim still guard the presence of God in a tabernacle where not everybody can go into the Holy of Holies, but one man once a year can go there, the high priest, as part of Yom Kippur. And I'm suggesting that it looks back to the garden, to a time when God and man, before sin entered, dwelled together. Okay. And I'm gonna keep this at a high level, but just keep this in mind. So when you get to Solomon's temple, when he builds it and you start reading about it like in First Kings, the walls inside it are carved with palm branches, cherubim, and other floral decor, flowers, foliage. Okay. Why? Because it's a reminder of the garden when God and man dwell together. It's the whole point. It becomes, in a world that's now corrupted and cursed, it becomes that place where God and man can connect during that time, that dispensation, if you will, through the law of Moses and the priesthood. But it's a microcosm of the garden. When you get to the new temple, he goes out of his way not just to give us the dimensions, but to tell us about the artwork, the cherubim on the walls, including in the porticos that I read earlier, and I pointed out about the palm trees there. But when you get into further, you're going to find more cherubim and more palm trees. He keeps coming back to that. That's what one of the things he's talking about in these reminiscences. But it actually makes perfect sense because this temple will also look back to a time when God and men dwelled together in the garden before sin, but it's also propelling forward. When you get to, and of course we're skipping over, there's a temple during the tribulation. We won't talk too much about that here now. God doesn't seem, that's like not part of God's plan. He takes it out. I mean, what I mean is, I don't think that temple is one like this where God is the architect. I'm going to say it that way. But when you get to the end of Revelation, sometimes we call it the eternal state, that there is no temple anymore. Why? Because the whole earth and the celestial city, it's all now the garden where man and God dwell together. These temples, they look back, but they also look forward to a coming time when that restriction where you could only experience this in this limited way of a high priest going in once a year, that'll be removed. So understand that, that's the palm trees is in some other things about it. I mean, there's a lot of other details in how it's designed that looks back and forward to God and man dwelling together. And these are some of the reminiscences and some other things, like there being an altar and things like that. So Bach goes on. And he says, he acknowledges the explicit instructions to build the described structure, but he says explicit instructions to build it, the explicit instructions are to the, to the dimensions, but he says there's no explicit instructions to build it. Let me tell you why that is silly, because it's clear God's going to build it. That is, he's going to be in charge of it, and especially in Zechariah. In those 8-night visions, this comes up, and God talks about Messiah building it. I guess I should actually just flip over there and grab a passage for you, real quick, a verse. This is Zechariah 6, the 8-night visions. Maybe one day we'll go through those and really spend some time with them, but they're in a big chiasm. And at the end of the visions, there's a number of oracles in there that build on it, but the whole thing is about a coming priest king. The center point, if you know what a chiasm is, it's kind of an organizational structure where lines of writing will correspond. Usually the first line and the last line correspond, the second line and the second to last line, and they kind of have a center or a climax. And the climax of these visions is about Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest, who are viewed as branches of olive trees standing by the Lord of the whole earth. And then you get this oracle, you know, it's a joining of the of like the a figure of a king and a priest. And at the end of the visions, there's an oracle where in chapter 6, verse 9, the prophet is told to get some silver and gold from some people that came out of the exile, and to make some crowns that they then put on the head of Joshua. Joshua is a Levitical high priest. He cannot have a king's crown, but he's a picture of a coming priest king. To have a priest king, you've got to have a new covenant that's a different kind of covenant. And that coming priest king is the Messiah. And after he puts him, you know, the crown on his head and says, basically, Israel, this is your future, a coming priest king, a reuniting of these two offices, which of course is a priest king after the order of Melchizedek. We get that out of Hebrews. But he says in chapter 6, verse 14, the crown will reside in the Lord's temple as a memorial to these men that gave the money for it. When Zerubbabel and Joshua finished the temple in their day, the crown was kept in there to always remind them, of course, the gift these men gave, but of this sign that this temple was really a shadow of things to come. Well, what things to come? A different temple with a different priesthood that would include a priest king, the temple we're reading about in Ezekiel. And here's the verse I wanted you to hear. Verse 15, people who are far off, that's like Gentiles, will come and build the Lord's temple, not Zerubbabel's temple, this future temple. And you will know that the Lord of armies has sent me to you. This will happen when you fully obey the Lord your God. This temple is seen as future. And I want to read you, well, let me leave it there. Let me just say, if you spend some more time in Zechariah 1 through 6, you'll get some more of this imagery. And he talks in particular about a cornerstone of this future temple project. And on the cornerstone, or the cornerstone is not the right word, capstone, maybe. On the capstone is an engraving that God makes. And it has on it the seven eyes of God. You'll see it referenced in Zechariah 3 and 4, and it will come up in Revelation. And it shows that the capstone for the new temple is living, not a dead rock, a living. It's looking forward. And I think it's looking forward to Messiah. So having said that, my point is, you know, you get these kinds of objections. Like this, you know, no explicit instructions to build the described structure. Yeah, but like we're even told that people are going to come from foreign nations to Israel to help build it. Furthermore, not only does the design display many idealistic features, Bach writes, the dimensions recorded are exclusively horizontal measurements, right? That's actually not true. We just read that the gate was 10 and a half feet thick and high. I mean, I read that earlier, the outer gate. So not everything that it put in writing is true. Accordingly, the purpose of this temple tour must be sought elsewhere. The precision in the measurements and the presences and in size of the gateways, the emphasis on purity, the centrality of the altar, and the strict regulations controlling access to the inner court are designed to shame Ezekiel's audience for past abuses. Expressed positively, Ezekiel envisions a day when abominations in the sanctuary cease and all Israel worships Yahweh in spirit and truth. Well, that sounds pretty hip and cool, except it's not true. What he's doing is Ezekiel is trying to encourage the people by showing them a glorious future that still remains for Israel. And that's what exactly what Zechariah does. Well, later he describes the passage in this sense. The prophet will be given a tour of a heavenly residence of God, of which the tabernacle and the Jerusalem temple have been but replica. So kind of suggesting that this is really just the heavenly temple, not, which is referenced in Ezekiel, I mean, in Hebrews. G.K. Beale, I've tried reading a lot of his stuff. It is dense. He's considered a first-rate scholar, and certainly his material is scholarly. I disagree with him on tons of stuff, but he's extremely educated. He, like Bach, rejects the literal view. Those, and I'm quoting from him, G.K. Beale, "Those who see a literal temple structure as the fulfillment of Ezekiel's prophecy usually interpret the sacrifices there to be memorial sacrifices that commemorate Christ's death." And this is true. Dispensationalists almost always, and I would include me in this, view them as the sacrifices that are going to be done as a bit of a memorial of Christ's death. In response, numerous commentators have pointed out that this would violate the principle of Hebrews. And he's quoting the print, verses in Hebrews that tell us that Christ died once for all, and so there don't need to be any more sacrifices. In fact, and I agree with him, going back in the time when the book of Hebrews is written, going back to the old animal sacrifices, wouldn't make any sense. He tells them that. And so he continues, "This would appear to amount to a reversal of redemptive history, and more importantly, a denial of the efficacy rather, of Christ's sacrifice." So Fruchtenbaum, Arnold Fruchtenbaum, who probably most of you are familiar with, he captures this issue. He says, "A common argument against taking the verses literally is the question as to why such a system," meaning animal sacrifices, "would be necessary since the Messiah has already died. If the death of Christ was the final sacrifice for sin, how can these animal sacrifices provide an expiation for sin? Therefore, some say the chapters of Ezekiel must be not taken literally." But here's the thing. No dispensationalist is arguing that these animal sacrifices deal with sin for a very simple reason. No dispensationalist believes that the animal sacrifices in the Old Testament under the law expiated sin, right? So if they didn't expiate sin, why did they happen? You can't say, well, if we don't need another sacrifice for sin, then there can't be, that's why there can't be animal sacrifices. Read the book of Acts. The Apostle Paul, after his conversion, he goes to Jerusalem. He does some of their rituals, including having animal sacrifices made for him. He knew they didn't deal with sin. So that's really not a good objection because it's a straw man. No dispensationalist is arguing it. I'm going to skip some of these quotes. Let me see if I got one more, maybe a good one here. This is a Pentecost concludes, "The system to be inaugurated in the millennial age will be a new order that will replace the Levitical order." This is important. Why would it replace it? He says, "For there are too many changes, deletions, and additions to the old order to sustain the contention that literally interpreted Ezekiel teaches the institution of Levitical order again." The new temple, and I see a hand raised, I'll come right to you in a second. The new temple is a new covenant temple. And while there will be some similarities, including the fact that there are some animal sacrifices, those sacrifices were never a solution to sin. They were, in the Old Testament, a means for fellowship. And in the New Temple, there will be some of this, but much of the, really most of the Levitical stuff, including the Law of Moses, that's gone. People read it and they're thinking about reinstituting Law of Moses and those sacrifices in that way, and it's not exactly what it's saying. And then one other comment on that, and I may leave up, well, I think I'll stop sharing. One other comment on that is we didn't talk about the feast, but what he's gonna say, and we'll cover more next time, is that some of the feast will be kept, namely Passover, unleavened bread, and Feast of Tabernacles. Okay. And I just, I want to keep that in mind because others like Yom Kippur are not mentioned. We'll talk more next time about why that matters a lot. Susan?
I'm thinking that there's going to be it's going to be perfect environment in the millennium, but it's not going to be the eternal state. And there will be people who are born who do not believe.
Yes.
And everybody's living in this wonderful, I mean, to me, compared to today, it sounds wonderful. So it would be like the happily ever after, and people might tend to forget what Jesus did in order to guarantee the salvation of the human race. And so, by having animal sacrifices, however often or whatever it is, those things, I mean, for me as an animal lover, they would definitely remind me of the torture, and not just the physical torture, but the spiritual torture that Christ went through because of paying for the sins of the human race. And there are going to be people who need to know that and need to see that all this happiness and everything's perfect is not the natural state, and it hasn't always been the natural state. Don't take it for granted, because who is this king? What did this king do? He looks great now, but what did he go through before? So that's my take on it.
Yeah, it's in that view that it looks back, has an important parallel, right? We keep the Lord's Supper, and we talked a lot about that actually last week, although it may have been after the recording stopped. But the Lord's Supper looks back and looks forward, because the Lord's Supper, so we shouldn't be surprised by having a memorial. The Lord's Supper looks back to the sacrifice of Christ, but also forward because it inaugurated the new covenant. There will be a large population of people in the millennium who are not resurrected already. They are the people who have survived the tribulation period. They are all believers when they go in. There will presumably be non-believers born later. There's indication in the Old Testament children will be born during this time. A big problem for us is simply that with our modern aesthetics and sort of our sense of things, even though most of us, not all of us, most of us are okay with slaughtering animals all the time, we just usually aren't there to do it and to see it. And so a lot of people are bothered by the Old Testament system, which, had the slaughtering of the animals. And it's going to talk about it, I didn't get to it yet, but there's kitchen areas. I mean, they slaughter the animals, but they cook them, right? And eat them. We don't seem, most of us, again, I'll probably eat a cheeseburger later if I get a chance. We don't have a problem with that. But we sometimes have a problem when we see it. So we kind of, there's sometimes there's kind of a bias against it. Well, we'll dig into this a little more next time, but it's not the main objection to this stuff being literal is the one I quoted from like Beal and Bach, that you just don't need more animal sacrifices. But the reality is, you never needed animal sacrifices because they could get rid of sins. So it's a theologically flawed objection. The animal sacrifices had a purpose that was not eliminating sin in the Old Testament, and they have a purpose in the future millennium that is not eliminating a sin. But there will be sinners. And when they commit sin, there will be some level of sacrifices connected to it. Think about why Passover and unleavened bread and tabernacles would be celebrated in the millennium, but not Pentecost, Yom Kippur, and Feast of Trumpets. Okay. Why not those? Right? When we talk about, so there's some pulling of some of those feasts. We're not told they're celebrated exactly the same way, but we are told they're celebrated. We'll get to that in Ezekiel, but why those and not the others? Think about that theologically, and particularly tabernacles. Tabernacles is so central. Tabernacles is you know it, anyway it looks back and it looks forward. When Peter was at the Mount of Transfiguration, he saw Jesus. He wanted to build him a tabernacle, like in the Feast of Tabernacles. So we had to kind of put that together. I'm going to stop the recording there.